From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week review the Elton John biopic Rocketman, starring Taron Egerton. Also hear about Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and Ma, starring Octavia Spencer and Diana Silvers. We'll also preview the summer movies now that we're into the official summer movie season. All comes your way here on Film Week on KPCC.
I miss the earth so much, I miss my life. It's lonely out in space. On such a timeless flight.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Rocket Man from the new Elton John biopic, directed by Dexter Fletcher, written by Lee Hall. Taron Egerton stars as Elton John. Joining me this week, film critics Lael Lowenstein and Tim Cockshell. Tim, please start us off on Rocket Man.
Rocket Man, directed by Dexter Fletcher, which is interesting because Dexter was brought in to finish Bohemian Rhapsody
for Bryan Singer.
So here Dexter is again with this movie. And you would think, because, you know, the Bohemian Rhapsody, Rocket, you get kind of similar sort of things, you know, these big biopics of big gigantic rock stars. But this is completely and totally different than all of the other sort of biopics about rock stars for me, for one reason specifically. Elton John's not dead. He makes it. So when you're watching this movie, which is full of music, and we go to some dark places, you know, he had addiction problems and all kinds of issues, and he was always kind of living on the edge there, particularly at the beginning of his career. But you watch this movie, and even when you're in these darkest, darkest places, somehow you don't feel that weight because you know he makes it. I did not watch this movie with that knot of anguish in my stomach. You know, all the ones who died when they were 27.
Yeah, what happens to Freddie Mercury?
And all that. That knot is not in your stomach with this movie because you know he's going to make it. You know it's going to be okay. And that just made it a lovely, lovely experience. It starts with Elton as a young, young boy, a prodigy, a child prodigy. I didn't know Elton John was a child prodigy. I mean, real, we're talking about Mozart-level child prodigy. His parents, his aunties, who he lives with, and all of that. And we follow him through his entire career. Right up to that first performance at the Troubadour. And I mean,
right here in LA.
Right here in LA. And that sequence is just this beautiful sequence to me. People have talked about how that night was, I think I heard it on John's show, if I'm not mistaken.
We did a whole segment with people calling in who had been there that night.
And I don't think I'm giving anything away then when folks talk about how the audience felt like it was levitating. So what they do in this movie is they just levitate them. They just float them. And I'm like, you know what? That little piece of literalness was just beautiful to me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And Taron Egerton is just killing that Elton John.
Lael, what'd you think?
So I mostly really liked it. I think Taron Egerton is an absolutely spectacular actor to watch. He's Welsh, but he's already played a British icon of sorts in Eddie the Eagle a few years back, different kind of icon. And here he is as Elton John. Unlike Rami Malek's take on Freddie Mercury, this isn't so much a physical embodiment of Elton John. It's more like a distillation. Like he kind of gets the essence of Elton John. He does, you know, he sort of simulates the look, but they're physically different kinds of people. And but I felt like he really goes for the essence, the pathos, and so that comes through very clearly. There's something odd in the way the film is structured, which is that it's got this framing device of it begins at a rehab meeting with Elton having stormed out of his Madison Square Garden concert and in full regalia, headdress and feathers and everything, arrives at an AA meeting to talk about the fact that he's an addict and he needs help. There are some liberties that are taken, and then it goes back in time. He's looking at him. He's talking to young Reggie at that point, and it goes in and out of the past. It goes into the sort of more recent past, and it takes off as a musical. This is a full fledged musical, mm-hmm. unlike say Bohemian Rhapsody, where the songs are, you know, specific to the scenes, or there's incidents where they're writing the songs. Here, the songs themselves move the narrative forward. Let's say Mamma Mia, for example. That's a difficult thing to pull off, to take songs that already exist and then structure a narrative around them. Now, because Elton John and his songwriting partner Bernie Taupin wrote these songs together, a lot of them are very, very personal. And it actually does work. It works to take songs like I'm Still Standing or songs like, you know, Your Song or you know, Sorry
Tiny
Seems
Dancer. Yeah.
Tiny Dancers.
Yeah.
Sorry seems to be the hardest word. And use them narratively. And they, it's done successfully, I think, for the most part. Sometimes it feels just a little bit contrived, but it's got a freeness and a lightness and a sort of Bollywoodness to it at times as well. That's a lot of fun to watch.
And I like the fact that they explore that relationship between Elton and Bernie, which is, you know, I mean, a lot of people don't know about that relationship for years and years and years. A lot of folks thought Elton wrote all the lyrics to those songs because Bernie was such a behind the scenes sort of figure. So it's an interesting thing to bring that relationship to the fore, and you come to understand exactly how come that guy's lyrics go perfectly with that guy's music.
Well, and when they work separately, wasn't the same thing.
Yeah. Right. And Bernie played so well by Jamie Bell here. Just absolutely. I think that was the true kind of love story of the film, although they never had a relationship, you know, a romantic relationship. They their partnership was just absolutely the essence of friendship and connection and communication. And I love the way that was represented.
You know, 15 years ago, Jamie Bell would have played Elton in this movie if they had made this movie 15 years ago.
Perhaps you're right, yeah.
Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic, starring Taron Egerton. Dexter Fletcher directed. Lee Hall wrote the screenplay. It's rated R in wide release. Godzilla, King of the Monsters, stars Kyle Chandler and Vera Farmiga. It's directed by Michael Dougherty, and Dougherty co-wrote it with Zach Shields. Tim.
Yeah, so apparently all of the studios must have a universe in which elements from their library can be explored. Obviously, we know the Marvel Universe and all of that. I think Universal, they tried to do something with those monsters.
Yeah, the Wolfman.
That didn't quite work out. So Warner Brothers over here has been working on this whole sort of universe situation. That 2014 Godzilla film was the first one. Kong, Skull Island, with Samuel L. Jackson was the second one. And now we have Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Basically, this is a girl and her monster story, is what it really is, because you have this young woman involved in the movie. You have something called the Cryptozoological Society. I'm not really sure if that's a real thing, but anyway, they exist. And all of these, what they call god monsters, that they, at this point in the story, had thought were myths, turn out not to be myths. They're found. So basically what you have here is Godzilla, who's going to go head to head with all of the great monsters of Japanese horror films that you've ever seen. So here comes Rodan.
Mothra there?
Mothra is going to be there.
Got it, Mothra.
And of course, the three-headed sort of dragon monster. It's funny, after Game of Thrones, though, all of this seems kind of ordinary. It's like dragons and stuff like that. They're everywhere nowadays. And the thing of it is, these monsters intend to destroy the world. And finally, they figure out the only way that we can stop them is if we have a monster of our own, a monster that's on our side. And fortunately, Godzilla seems to be down with the humans. And they bring Godzilla back, and then they just go at it. You know, that's all there is. It's the same Godzilla from the 2014 movie. It looks like it with the scales and all that kind of stuff. The sound effects in this movie are extraordinary. That roar that Godzilla does, I got to tell you, I kind of love that. I kind of love that. I think I might make that a dial tone on my phone.
I say it's still hard. I still think of Godzilla as Japanese. It's hard for me to think of, you know, him set outside of Tokyo.
You know, that original Godzilla movie with Perry Mason.
Raymond Burr. Yeah, they spliced that in afterwards for the U.S. audience.
That was a really, really dead serious movie. People remember it, you know, metaphors for the nuclear, like, all that kind of. That's a dead serious movie. Sometimes in the mid-70s, these movies became sort of funny and silly and devolved into all kinds of things. There was even a gigantic robot Godzilla in some movie that had to fight the real Godzilla. These movies are trying to take it a bit more serious. I'm not sure that's the right way to go because all of this is kind of silly. Now, you can't go silly like I think with that 1998 movie with Matthew Broderick.
Oh, boy. That was the nadir of Godzilla movies, I thought. That was. And it was preceded by this marketing campaign that was brilliant because all the billboards said, you know, he's bigger than this billboard. He's bigger than the Empire State Building. Yeah. He's bigger than the Eiffel Tower. And by the time the movie came out, he seemed really small.
But it was William Castle level promotion.
Yes, it was.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters, rated PG-13 in wide release. And by the way, the young woman in the film who befriends Godzilla, that's Millie Bobby Brown of Stranger Things on Netflix. Ma is a horror film starring Octavia Spencer, Diana Silvers, and Juliette Lewis. Tate Taylor directs. Scotty Landis, the screenwriter. Tim?
Tate Taylor, director of The Help, with Octavia Spencer, of course. So this is a revenge thriller. It's sort of obvious from the trailer that that's what's going on here. The hook is whether or not the audience will feel for our antagonist, played by Octavia Spencer, this older black woman, who one day is approached by a few kids to go and buy them a little bit of liquor. And, you know, first, she's like, yeah, I'm reluctant to do it, but she does it. Then she invites them to come hang out at her house and hang out down there in the basement and do their thing. And then she starts getting...
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah. It gets kind of crazy sweet. And then she starts hanging out with the kids. Well, there's something going on here, and the audience can figure that out fairly quickly. This is why this movie works to me, though. This movie is about race without ever mentioning race. They don't talk about it. So we see in flashbacks Octavia's character is a little girl, and we see how she's treated by, you know, she's introverted and all that, and we see how she's treated by the other kids. Again, nothing specifically about race is indicated here, but you feel like it's at work. So that when we come to this point in the film where she's taking her revenge and we've seen how she was treated, you kind of get this feeling of, you know what, you might have that coming. You might have that coming, guys. You treated her really bad. Now, she's crazy, and we have to see that. But something in my bones said, you might have that coming. It goes a little Misery. Remember, like that. So, yeah.
How and how does Spencer do in this role? Because this is so different than we're used to seeing her.
To me, that's the thing that holds. Again, the movie itself, fairly ordinary in the tropes that go on, but it's her. Because when she goes bananas, really crazy, I mean, she pulls the ripcord and she is gone. So she's having all kinds of fun. And I'm like, yes, sis. So anyway, good movie in that way.
Ma is the horror film from director Tate Taylor. It's rated R in wide release. Also out this week, the Egyptian adventure drama Yomadine stars Radig Amal. It's written and directed by A.B. Shawkey. Tim?
I love this movie. This is my favorite movie of the week. This might be my favorite movie of the year. It's just a beautiful, beautiful film about this Egyptian man and a little boy whose name happens to be Obama, and they're in a donkey. That's mostly what we're watching in this movie. The man was dropped off at a leper colony when he was a child, an infant, and spends his entire life at this leper colony. He finds out as the movie begins and his wife passes away that there is a record of his family. One thing that they know about his family is where they were from, and he decides that he's going to leave the leper colony. He's cured of the leprosy, but you can see the remnants of the leprosy all over his face.
He's disfigured his face, his hands.
His hands are deformed. Actually are. This is this actor's first film. Very De Sica in that way. And he's just a wonderful actor. And you start watching this movie and the way he's interacting with all of these people in the movie. And the leper colony, it's really a beautiful place. They love each other. They take care of each other. Even the folks who don't have leprosy but are there to take care of the lepers love these people and take care of them. And then he wanders off into this world with the little boy Obama and that donkey to find his family. And
Obama stows away in his wagon, which is a little bit of a cliche, but it's so cute. There are times, look, I agree with you, Tim. I actually thought this was a really, really beautiful film and about something that you never see, you know, depicted. I mean, how often do we see leprosy in narrative films? Not often at all. And so there are elements of it that are incredibly traditional, like, you know, it's a buddy movie. It's a road movie. It's this mismatched duo of the older guy and the boy, and they kind of start off, arguing and disliking each other, but then they come together and, you know, through these adventures that they have, they bond. And I felt for the most part it really did kind of earn its moments of sentiment. And I want to just point out also the score was absolutely beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
It was just right. It just like moved the action along. It expressed the director's tone. This director, this was his first feature, mm-hmm. by the way, first feature. And it also was chosen for competition at the Cannes Film Festival, which is pretty amazing for a first feature. And it's really a lovely, heartwarming
story. The cinematography, too.
Story.
Not only in the cinematography, not in the vistas and whatnot, yes, but what they choose to show us. He takes this camera and he leaves it on this man's face. His leprosy scarred face, and he just leaves it there. He makes you look at it, and eventually it stops. You don't cringe anymore.
You don't notice it.
It goes away. So, yeah. You start looking at his eyes. There is humanity forever in this actor's eyes, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's a very, very humanist kind of film. And I just wanted to point out also the composer is Omar Fadel, who I think did an absolutely tremendous job here.
The Egyptian adventure drama Yomadin is written and directed by A.B. Shaki. Radhi Gamal and Ahmed Abdelhafiz are the stars of the unrated film. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Coming up, the romantic comedy Always Be My Maybe and the French-Canadian film The Fall of the American Empire. We'll talk about the Denis Arcand film, I don't know if this is a re-release of it or what. We'll find out coming up on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Tim Cockshell and Leah Lowenstein. Next up is Always Be My Maybe, directed by Nanochka Khan. It stars Ali Wong as famous chef Sasha, who reunites with her childhood friend Marcus.
Hey!
Hi, Marcus.
Yeah, hi, Sasha. Hi. Hello. Hi.
Sasha Tran!
Mr. Kim!
You're like our own Asian Oprah. How much money do you have now?
Be serious.
Tim, what'd you think of Always Be My Maybe?
I thoroughly enjoyed this perfectly lovely little romantic comedy. You know, rom-coms have had a rough time here, you know, over the last, I don't know, 20 years, really. It depends on how far you want to go back. But this is just lovely. It's just When Harry Met Sally. That's all it is. Just when it's, you know, more or less When Harry Met Sally. But the thing of it is, When Harry Met Sally is a fantastic story. And if you do it right, with the right beats and wonderful writing, and it's really, really funny, it will work every single time. So in this one, we have food culture, hip-hop culture, and Asian culture all sort of melded together into this story. But the way I love the way they present it, because they just present all of this as American culture. It's not specifically about being Asian or anything. It's just all of this stuff together adds up to American culture. So you have this lovely story. They were friends 15 years ago, had their first sexual experience together in the back of his Toyota Corolla. And then she goes off and becomes incredibly successful and famous. He has kind of a blue-collar life working with his dad, but at night he does hip-hop. Now, this is what's interesting about this. He's good. I mean, he can go. And you go and see him. He's got on that black hat, and they do this music, and they're taking it dead bang serious. I like that they're not attempting to demean him or make it a joke that this Asian guy is doing this. No, that's not a joke. That's what he does, and he's really, really good at it. The movie has all kinds of romantic comedy tropes in it, back and forth. She'd like him to do a little bit more with his life. He feels out of place within her culture. And you know, the boyfriend that dumps her, so now she has to find another boyfriend. Then Keanu Reeves shows up, the wonderfully fantastic Keanu Reeves. I'm sorry, I'm nuts about him. He's just great. And I'm not going to ruin anything about the movie, but he is so self-effacing in this movie. He pokes fun at his own image, you know, as Keanu Reeves. In this movie, he just tears it to shreds. Anybody who can do that is extremely confident, and he is hysterical in this movie. It's a really, really sweet and funny movie.
Always Be My Maybe. The co-stars, by the way, Ali Wong and Randall Park, were guests on The Frame with John Horn. You can hear that conversation by visiting kpcc.org/theframe. We also have a link on our Film Week page. Always Be My Maybe, starring Ali Wong and Randall Park, is directed by Nanochka Khan, and you can see it both streaming on Netflix as well as at the Vintage Los Feliz 3. It's rated PG-13. Denis Arcand, the French-Canadian writer-director, did a critically acclaimed film, The Decline of the American Empire, a terrific movie. His new film is The Fall of the American Empire, also a comedy starring Maxim Roy and Jan Englund. Leo, what'd you think of the new Arcand film?
I really enjoyed it. Where that film took on American sexual mores and was, I think, critical of what's going on here, this one looks at a great many other things, including our economy, the way sex is used as a commodity, the way politics has become infiltrated. And essentially, the story is a young delivery man happens to stumble onto a heist which has gone wrong. He quickly quickly, thinking on the spot, decides to grab the bags of money, grab the loot, stuff them in his truck, and he doesn't have a plan. But he decides, you know, sort of unexpectedly to just completely change his life. Of course, he's a bit hapless and sort of bumbling and doesn't really know what to do. So he knows that he needs help. He enlists the assistance of Rémy Girard, who's a guy who's been in a lot of Archon films, including The Barbarian Invasions, that wonderful movie from a few years ago. And he also comes into play with a lovely young prostitute who has a heart of gold, of course. And so the three of them sort of concoct the scheme to outwit the cops, outwit the gangsters, and, you know, sort of turn the action on its head. In some ways, it's kind of reminded me of, like, The Big Short, for instance, because it shows just how creatively one can make money disappear if needed. I won't go into too much detail, but I love the way Archon blends different genres. I mean, this is satire. It's a romance. It's also a thriller. It's got a lot of kind of noir elements, and that's a difficult thing to do, to move so seamlessly between genres. A lot of directors can't do that. He's one of the ones that really can successfully. He's also a really strong writer as well.
Did you see Jesus of Montreal?
No.
Yes, yeah. I love that one too.
Yeah, yeah. He's one of my favorites. The Fall of the American Empire in French, the French Canadian production from writer-director Denis Arcand. It's rated R and at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The documentary Halston tells the story of the superstar designer. It's directed by Frederick Chang and unrated. Tim?
The superstar designer, and he was at one point one of the most important American designers in the world, Halston. And what this movie is about is what happened to that, because the brand Halston more or less has fallen out of circulation. So this film is engaged in exploring that specifically. It has a weird device in it. They have this, it's all like a detective thing that's going on. This woman.
I didn't like that device.
I hated that
device.
That was
so unnecessary. That was the worst thing about it.
You don't need that. For one thing, the film is about Halston. He's an interesting person who's had a very interesting life.
He deserves a documentary in and of himself.
All by himself. You didn't need any of that. Apparently, he either walked around with a camera crew most of his life, because, I mean, there is footage of him everywhere in his office at home, just walking down the street. Why is there a shot of you just walking down the street for no reason? There's all that kind of stuff. Starts interestingly. The film starts, more or less, Halston is already a person. He's a hat maker for Bergdorf Goodman.
Bergdorf Goodman, yes. He was the milliner.
And he's the person who designed that pillbox hat that Jackie Kennedy wore. That was Roy Halston who did all that. And it, so more or less, made his career.
Mm-hmm.
And Eliza Scher, you name him. He was dressing all the biggies. And the interesting thing about Roy was from Iowa.
Mm.
But he talked like he was from the upper edge of British society. It was all an act. It was this act that he put on. And it worked. I like the way they did this film, in that they don't tell you about his upbringing and his young life, until the end of the movie. That was sort of interesting to me. You watch this entire story of Halston, and then they go back to 1922, and they talk about his entire life. Again, black and white footage, black and white photography of every moment of his childhood. It's just, it's interesting the way some people are documenting.
Do they get into how he leveraged celebrities to build his brand?
Yes, and Liza Minnelli is one of those who actually speaks in the film, and she testifies to that. Elsa Peretti as well, the jewelry designer who worked with Halston, actually designed his perfume bottle. That was one of the first, I think the first celebrity designer perfume bottle. So they do talk to and talk about the celebrities. What struck me also that I didn't realize was Halston was the progenitor of so much that we now associate with fashion, from the designer perfume bottle to designing for the Olympic athletes. He was the first one to do that. He was actually the first designer to strike a deal with a major marketing chain, that being JCPenney, which quickly got him kicked out of Bergdorf Goodman because they thought it was so déclassé to be doing, you know, doing a deal with JCPenney.
It was an interesting. I remember that. I remember when Halston came into JCPenney. JCPenney was the place where I shop, my family shop. And we couldn't afford any of these sorts of high-end things like that. But you went to JCPenney and you could buy Halston. And it meant something to people from my class of society. But the upper elite, the upper crust, they did not care for that. And they shunned him after that. It was really sort of brutal.
But he talked about how he wanted fashion to be accessible to the masses, to the, you know, to everybody. And, you know, even though he had his fancier lines, you know, he really wanted people to be able to access his stuff. The other thing, too, was just how clean his lines were, how beautifully they moved. That's discussed as well. He was the first to sort of notoriously do the bias cut of a lot of these things. And
He didn't use zippers.
That's right. You could have a one piece draping of a dress that fit beautifully.
He died at the age of 57.
Yeah. Yes, AIDS. And yeah, that's addressed in the film also, just his how hard it was for him to come out and deal with that.
Halston, documentary about the fashion designer Frederick Chang, is the director. It's unrated at the New Art Theater in West L.A. The international co-production Domino is directed by Brian De Palma. Peter Scavlin is the screenwriter. What'd you think, Lael?
Well, I was not a big fan of this movie. I think Tim liked it a bit better than I did.
I will admit that it's a flat-out mess.
It was a mess. Yeah. It was a mess. I mean,
a likable mess.
Well, okay. First of all, whereas with Yomadine that we talked about, I thought the score was absolutely beautiful and contributed in a really positive way. In this case, I thought the score was way over the top and completely took me out of the movie. That was one of the biggest detractors for me, was how obstreperous the score was. It was in my face. So this is a crime movie where set in Copenhagen, well, set in a couple of countries where Nikolai Coster-Waldau is
from Game of Thrones.
From Game of Thrones, yes, the very hunky Danish actor is pursuing criminals who actually it leads him to following ISIS, and there's, you know, it's a bloody mess in many, many ways. I thought it was narratively just kind of a disaster. I couldn't understand what was going on. I felt like, what happened to De Palma here? De Palma, the great Hitchcock worshiper, like, where is he gone? I don't know.
Well, you know, if you think about it, Brian De Palma's really only made about three or four films that are actually really, really good, and the rest of them are like these serviceable films, right?
There have been a few. Okay,
yeah, three or four.
Scarface.
This is serviceable.
Yeah, okay.
Snake Eyes.
Mission Impossible.
But what I like about this movie is this movie moves. You're right about that score. But this movie moves. The action sequences are just fantastic. That thing that happens when they're on the roof, what happens is the guy kills his partner or almost kills his partner. He goes after him. It's an intense, intense set of action sequences. And to me, that makes the movie work. It hangs together on that alone.
Domino from director Brian De Palma. It's at the AMC Rolling Hills 20 in Torrance, rated R. The documentary The Proposal tells the story of the artist Luis Barragán. The film is directed by Jill Magid. Tim?
The architect, Luis Barragán, who's Mexico's most important architect. He's designed many, many notable buildings in Mexico. He's designed entire subdivisions in Mexico City, in Guadalajara. His own home is a museum now. His entire archive is held by this French company, a French manufacturing company, who has put it in the hands of this particular woman named Frederica Zanco. She's an Italian architectural historian. But his entire archive is in Switzerland, which is just this weird thing. The director here, Jill Magid, who is herself actually an artist, she is trying to get the archive returned to Mexico, right? Now, this is a weird story that goes like this. Rather than buying her a wedding ring, this rich Swiss guy buys that archive and gives it to Frederica and says, I'll give you this instead of a wedding ring. So what Jill does is she goes and has Luis's body dug up, and she gets some of his ashes, and she makes a ring out of his ashes. And she tells this woman, I'll give you this ring, which is his body, if you give me, or Mexico, back his body of work. It's just bizarre. I didn't like this movie at all because she's doing this. You take it.
Yeah, it's a weird movie. It's sort of almost like a love triangle in a way, because it's the director's sort of personal agenda to also mount an exhibition. And, it didn't totally work for me.
The Proposal, architect Luis Barragán, the focus of Jill Magid's film. It's unrated at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Coming right up, our critics, along with John Horn of the Frame, are going to preview the summer movie season. That's right, we're here. Memorial Day weekend is over. We're into the thick of summer. We'll hear what our critics are previewing. Come right after this. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We are just at the start of the official summer movie season coming out of Memorial Day weekend. We got a lot of big films and some counter-programming by more intimate movies designed to catch the adult audience that might be avoiding the latest blockbuster. With us to talk about the range of what's on the schedule, the host of KPECC's The Frame, John Horn. Also continuing with us, film critic Tim Cogshell. John, I know you've got your own summer movie preview that you're involved with. But let's start, first of all, with the films you're most eagerly anticipating.
Well, it will come as no small shock to Hollywood that I have little interest in most sequels, spinoffs, reboots, prequels, whatever you want to call them. So I'm always looking for original films. And I think what's interesting about this summer is a lot of the movies that I am most interested in premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and that typically is not the place that you would find indie films. They try to go to the fall or, you know, places where they won't be crushed by multi-billion dollar blockbusters. But I'll start with a couple. Late Night. It's a movie about a late night talk show host played by Emma Thompson. It's written by Mindy Kaling, who is also in it. It's an interesting movie about a woman whose career as a late night TV show host, so you know there's already fiction there because she's hosting a network late-night talk show. Her show is in peril. She's surrounded by male writers. She's trying to figure out how she can do things differently. And in comes to her life Mindy Kaling as this young writer who wants to shake things up. It's exactly what I like in a movie. It's an original story. It's not a sequel. It has a couple of great actors in it. And it's very much different from everything else we're going to see this summer. So comes out very soon. Late Night is going to kick my summer off for real.
So it comes out next week. And it sounds, John, like a kind of movie that the actors could really sink their teeth into these roles, that there could be a real theatrical platform in these movies.
And definitely. I mean, the filmmakers, you know, worked with real late night hosts. They made sure they were getting like what the writer's room was like, how a late night host prepares for his show, because as we know, there are no women who are hosting late night shows. But it does have a lot to say about diversity. And Emma Thompson herself has been a very outspoken advocate in terms of the Me Too movement. She was very famous a couple weeks ago for publishing a letter that was critical of Skydance Animation, the company inside Paramount that had hired John Lasseter, who was forced out of Pixar. She wrote an incredibly well thought out, argumentative letter about what was wrong with Skydance hiring John Lasseter to run its animation division. So Emma Thompson is not only in this as an actor, I think she's in it as this person who is really important in the Me Too movement and about representation in Hollywood.
There is Samantha Bee as a late night host.
But not every day. This is a daily. So yeah, Samantha Bee gets her once a week, but no women that I'm aware of gets a nightly talk show unless I'm missing something.
Chelsea Handler's probably the last one. Tim, what film are you particularly looking forward to this summer?
Well, I'll say that I'm interested in seeing, and I'll go a different way from John. This is a sequel, an interesting sequel, Shaft. Shaft is back.
Sequel or reboot?
Reimagining.
Well, you got to be careful here.
The same human beings are in some of these movies. So Richard Roundtree is in this movie. So
all right.
John Shaft is in this movie.
Is Isaac Hayes' music?
Not Isaac Hayes' music, mostly, unfortunately. And then, of course, Samuel L. Jackson is in the movie, too, playing John Shaft, a character that he played in 2000 in John Singleton's film. John Singleton, not involved in this film. He recently passed, but he was not involved in this film at all, so far as I can see. And, of course, now we have another Shaft, a third Shaft. After, you know, because time has gone by. That original movie, 1971, guys. 1971. Yet it imprinted itself in the zeitgeist and the culture so deeply. 40 plus years later, we're still talking about John Shaft movies, and people can still hear that song in their head.
I hear that Cat Shaft is a bad movie.
shut your mouth.
I'm talking about Shaft.
I just saw it a couple months ago yet again. I just love that film.
Ernest Tidyman's film. That was a fantastic film. It was groundbreaking in a whole bunch of ways. He really never cared for thinking of it as a part of the black exploitation cinema
that was
popular at the time, because it was something different going on in those movies. John Singleton's movie from 2000, I was never a big fan of that movie, except for Jeffrey Wright. Jeffrey Wright made his bones in that movie, playing that Puerto Rican gangster, if you recall that film at all. Christian Bale was meant to be the sort of antagonist of that movie, but Jeffrey Wright just stole the whole movie away from everybody, frankly, including Samuel L. Jackson. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with Shaft now and what kind of things they bring to bear.
Well, in the original, it had the advantage that Richard Roundtree wasn't as known to movie audiences. Samuel L. Jackson arrived sort of with all the great roles
for
he's performed.
For better or worse. A lot of baggage.
A lot of it. So we get a new version of Shaft. John, Last Black Man in San Francisco. This is based on a personal story, right?
This is another Sundance movie. It's a movie that I was very fond of. It's incredibly personal. And again, this is part of what I'm talking about in the summer. We have so many sequels, you know, another Secret Life of Pets, another Men in Black movie, Toy Story, a story about two lifelong friends and about what their friendship means. And this is a movie that, you know, kind of it gets close to having some magical realism elements to it. It's a beautiful portrait about a specific neighborhood in San Francisco. And it's not a movie that's going to be, you know, hugely commercially successful, but it's a very intimate story about two friends and about how their friendship evolves over the course of, you know, a couple of weeks. It's about gentrification. It's about people who feel they need to put on a show. One of the characters is trying to do a theater piece in his house. It's a crazy movie, but again, it's completely original. And I think what's missing in so much of Hollywood, especially during the summer, is originality, even within, you know, so many of these remakes. And we'll see how original Shaft is. So again, that's more or less toward what I gravitate toward, but it's really because there's so little of that, especially in the summer months.
Last Black Man in San Francisco, just absolutely extraordinary film to my that score was so beautiful. It's set in a black community. These young black men, and there are these other young black men in that community.
It's the Fillmore District, right?
Yeah. And they just sort of hang out doing their thing. And I love the language in this movie. It almost sings at you, this movie. It's so poetic and beautiful. Painful, but in a certain sort of way, it also gives you a certain kind of release, this movie. Danny Glover in the movie plays the grandfather. Yeah. He's blind. It's just very poignant and sweet,
beautiful,
deeply moving movie.
That's a movie we're going to also be reviewing next week on Film Week, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Tim, one of the big films of the summer, Spider-Man Far From Home.
So this takes place post-Endgame. Everybody who knows the Marvel Universe knows what that means. And it's an interesting story that follows our young Spider-Man. I love this new young Spider-Man. My favorite Spider-Man had been Tobey Maguire. And we can talk about Spider-Mans the way we talk about Batmans, because everybody
knows. Well, there have been like seven Spider-Mans in the last 10 years, so you got
Garfield,
a big choice. Yeah.
So, but my favorite Spider-Man had been Tobey Maguire for a long time. But the young man playing Spider-Man today has a certain charm and vulnerability. I love that the Marissa Tomei is a hot Aunt May. So that's kind of neat in this movie that they do that. So the movie picks up where Endgame takes off, and Spider-Man has to figure out how he's going to acclimate himself into this world. We'll have to see where it goes and what it's all about, how it uses all of the tropes of the Marvel Universe and refers to all of them. It might be interesting. The director's a guy named John Watts, who directed a movie called Cop Car with Kevin Bacon, fairly intense little thriller. But where he really cut his bones was directing episodes of The Onion News on television. You know, it's just
really, the comedy show.
So it'll be interesting to see what he brings to bear, what skills he brings to bear in the production of a big, gigantic action summer movie.
And Samuel L. Jackson, of course, back.
He's in every movie.
Jackson.
He is not in Last Black Man in San Francisco, though.
Spider-Man Far From Home opens July 2nd. John, for you, another movie I know you're looking forward to is Yesterday. This is sort of a fantasy in which the Beatles play center stage.
Yeah, they do and they don't. So now, again, and it's interesting, the movies I'm recommending, I've seen. So I am not taking a leap on movies that just look good from the trailers. So I've seen Yesterday. So the writer is Richard Curtis, and I think a little Richard Curtis goes a really long way.
This is the Notting Hill Richard Curtis.
Yeah, Love Actually. I'm not a huge fan of Richard Curtis, but I am a huge fan of the director, Danny Boyle, and he did Slumdog Millionaire. So that's the team, the creative team. The idea behind the movie is the Beatles never existed. Some guy wakes up. He knows all their music, but nobody else does. So he decides he's going to make a fast buck get a lot of fame, stealing the Beatles' music, and what do you think?
But
doesn't,
what a concept.
Doesn't end up well.
Is it really stealing if they never existed?
We'll be back previewing the summer movies. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with the host of The Frame, John Horn, Leo Lowenstein, and Tim Cockshell, our film critics. We're talking about the summer movies, the summer season officially underway in the wake of Memorial Day weekend. Already got some real gems to talk about, or at least eagerly anticipated. Leo, let's get to one of your favorites, or at least what you have some anticipation around. Toy Story 4 is coming.
Yes, I have very mixed feelings about it because Toy Story 3 was one of those absolutely indescribably beautiful films and so rare. It's very, very seldom that the third film in a series is as good as the first. We were recently talking about How to Train Your Dragon, that one, the third one, and that was actually better than the second. I cannot imagine a fourth film in this series being better than Toy Story 3, which was, I believe, Oscar nominated and was just really sort of, I thought, completed the series. So I have mixed feelings about it, but Pixar usually doesn't let us down, so we'll see.
It is a tough act.
John's raising an eyebrow.
You missed Cars too.
But that was the rare miss in Pixar films. Also, Lion King, another Disney film, this live action version.
Okay, and I confess to slightly mixed feelings about this too, because I often don't feel like doing a live action version of, let's say, Dumbo, for example, is necessary. What a cast. Like, it's going to be amazing. I'm Donald Glover, and you know, just like the wow. I think the visuals, given what I've seen so far, and given the anticipation factor, it's also Disney's philosophy of just bringing it to a whole new audience, I think makes a lot of sense, I suppose. And, you know, if you're a diehard Lion King fan, why not? In this case, I would say embrace it.
Yeah, and Chiwetel Ejiofor as Scar, which seems like perfect casting. So, yes, a lot of good voices.
It's coming up in the middle of July, Disney's The Lion King. Tim, let me go to you for Dark Phoenix. What's that film about?
Yeah, Dark Phoenix. So here we go again, back into the X-Men universe, which we thought was done because, you know, Logan's, you know, you thought you would have ended the X-Men universe there. But they've managed to pull this thing off where they dabble around in time in the X-Men universe. So these are the younger X-people, X-children, X-young, I don't know, whatever you want to call them, as opposed to the old ones. So, and we play this whole role. And I don't know about this movie. Logan is the best of all of the X-Men films.
It was just an
extraordinary film, and it seemed to put a cap on it real nice. I'm not sure I want to undo any of that. So I'm with you, Lael, on that one. Sometimes it's like, you know what, guys? We're done.
Right.
Let's just call it done. But we're going to go at it one more time, and we'll see what happens. It's a debuting director. Now, he's been a producer for a long, long time, the fellow who's directing this movie, but he's a debuting director, so it'll be interesting to see where he goes.
Dark Phoenix, the film, and Lael, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino film, which played at the Cannes Film Festival a couple weeks ago.
Yes, so much excitement around that as there is around any Tarantino film. Of course, this is the one that he is saying is not the Manson movie. It's not about the murder, but it is, of course, set in the milieu of that time and takes a look at Hollywood and all of L.A. during an incredibly polarizing and exciting and intense period. So I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see what he does there. And the excitement has been just, you know, through the roof.
Our Justin Chang gave it a pretty strong review, I would say, with some reservations, but quite strong in the L.A. Times.
It feels right for Tarantino to turn to this. I mean, I think more than anything else, it feels like a filmmaker brought up in this milieu, coming back to it and giving his own personal take on it, I think should be good.
John, you want to tell us about Luce?
Yeah, Luce, another trend you're going to start detecting with me, another Sundance movie that was co-written and directed by a young filmmaker named Julius Ona. And it is about a young couple that have, well, I guess they're not that young. How about a white couple played by Naomi Watts and Tim Roth? And they have adopted a kid from Eritrea. And it's about whether or not he is Too Good to Be True, and about what they think about their son, who is a high school student, and what's happening around him in high school. It's really got some interesting questions about race and about class and about privilege and about the way you see your child and when your child becomes him or his or her own person. It's got a great turn from Octavia Spencer as a teacher in the school. Very provocative film. Amazing directorial debut from this young filmmaker, Julius Ona. We're going to be hearing a lot more from him. I thought this movie was fascinating. It'll be interesting to see how it does, in the marketplace again. But it's an interesting film and certainly worth checking out.
It'll be
I think he did a Cloverfield movie before he did Luce. So he did a Cloverfield movie a year ago, but Luce is, much more personal.
No monster here. So Luce comes out in early August. Also, you recommend The Kitchen.
The Kitchen is the first movie that I have not seen, but it's directed by Andrew Berloff. It is a mobster movie that was written and directed by a woman. It stars three women. It's about some mob wives who decide to take over their husband's business while they are locked up. I think we saw a not great version of this directed by Steve McQueen called Widows. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you guys. Mm-hmm. How you thought about that? I thought that was not that good for a guy who made 12 Years a Slave, but I've seen some footage from it. I've read the graphic novel on which it's based. Looks interesting. Dark, violent, with women in charge, shooting people, kicking butt, all that good stuff.
The Kitchen, that comes out later this summer. Lael, where'd you go, Bernadette? What's
yes.
that about?
Well, this is based on the runaway bestseller by Maria Semple about a woman who has raised a family and has sort of sacrificed for years and years, and she finally rediscovers her creative passions. Huge bestseller, I think, like an enormous number of weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and now it's being made by Richard Linklater, who, of course, is always interesting whenever he does a take on anything. And this is going to be, it's got Cate Blanchett, it's got Kristen Wiig, should be absolutely terrific. I'm excited.
All right. Where'd You Go, Bernadette, the film from later this summer. And Tim, I think we got your picks here. And John, one more from you, The Farewell.
The Farewell is a beautiful movie based on a true story about a woman whose grandmother, and correct me, guys, if I have this wrong, again, another Sundance movie, so you're getting the trend here. It's directed by Lulu Wang. It stars Awkwafina, about a young woman whose grandmother might be dying. They haven't told her because they don't want her to die. They don't want to break the bad news to her. So they kind of organize this sham wedding. Everybody travels back to spend time with the grandmother. It's a beautiful movie. Awkwafina is great in it. Lulu Wang wrote and directed it based on her own life experience. It was an episode, I believe, on This American Life before it became a movie. And it's certainly an interesting film.
Mm. Yeah, Tim.
One that recently came onto my radar, The Art of Self-Defense. Aaron Eisenberg, Imogene Poots. A man gets beat up really bad. He goes to a dojo and meets this eccentric sensei. And he learns how to defend himself. It's all about, it goes to some very dark places, a psychological thriller about what it means to be able to defend yourself. And does that, in fact, make you brutish? Interesting story.
What's the title of the film again?
The Art of Self-Defense.
The Art of Self-Defense. You'll see that later this summer, along with all the other movies that we've previewed in this segment of Film Week on KPCC. Thanks so much for joining us. We're here every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon for Film Week on 89.3. And we hope you join us in person Saturday, July 27th. Our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights at the Theater at Ace Hotel, 7 p.m. You can get your tickets at KPCC.org/in-person. Have a great day.